Matt Bowen.
Two throws. This one aired out for Galloway. And with contact, it's picked off. Intercepted by Matt Bowen.
NFL writer and analyst for ESPN.
The ball came out. Right now they're calling fumble. Matt Bowen knocked it out.
Seven-year NFL veteran.
We talked about it last week a little bit, Lawrence. You know, Dan was on vacation and all that. But when you were there last week working, we talked about how... I had to throw that in there.
Fight me, Bowen.
Defensive back coach for IC Catholic football.
One of the greatest things and the most rewarding things about being a high school coach is to see the impact it can have on your student athletes.
Matt Bowen with Bernstein and Holmes on 670 The Score.
Let Matt Bowen talk. Shut up.
This segment with Matt Bowen is brought to you by McGrath City Honda. When you do the math, you choose McGrath. The Bernstein and Holmes show. Marshall Harris is in for Lawrence today as we are sitting outside on Lake Street. 670 The Score, broadcasting live here in Lake Street Plaza at Prue. Thanks to our friends at Circa Sports Illinois. In just a little bit, Circa Sports Illinois will be bringing merch for customers to download the app and deposit. There are food trucks and games and footballs flying through the air. So all fun stuff. Matt Bowen, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. What's going on?
Well, Matt, I'm a little curious as to your level of belief that the Bears' offensive woes can be fixed this quickly for this high quality of an opponent.
I think you can make definite corrections, Dan. There's no doubt about that. Now, can you come back this week and put 35, 40 points on the board? I don't think you should believe that, but you can see more. Just basic stuff. Extending drives, right? One of the big narratives coming out of that game in week one is, well, Tennessee had the ball, right? Complete ball control. Well, that happens when you can't get first downs. You know, so where does that start? The third down passing game. What can we do to make corrections there against a team in Houston that is going to be more zone heavy at times? A lot of split safety coverage. How can we attack split safety coverage this week? How can we utilize the tight end position? Cole Kmet has to be a big part of the game plan this week, in my opinion, especially working the middle of the field versus those zone coverage. And with the quarterback, just get them to slow down a little bit. And you saw this with all the young quarterbacks this weekend. Caleb Williams, Jaden Daniels, Bo Nix. Their internal clock was moving too fast at times. And at times that forces you to play frenetically, both with footwork and with your eyes. And I think you can get Caleb in better situations, especially in those critical downs, where he has leveled reads, where he can get the ball out quickly. We can ID a positive matchup based on formation alignment and what you've seen in terms of defensive tendencies. They give him a clear and defined read where he can slow down, make the throw, move the sticks.
Matt, when you look at this offense, because that's what we're all paying attention to. I mean, the defense, no one's got any qualms with the way they played last week. But if there is no Rome Odunze, let's say there is no Keenan Allen, what can they do to maximize what they do have available to them if that's the case?
I think, Marshall's a great question, and obviously, my first answer is to run the football. Okay, we didn't see enough of that last week. And I know the term established a run game gets overplayed, but can you have more efficiency, more production running the football? Can you start to mirror your run and pass game together? Because I'm telling you, that's what you're going to see from Houston on Sunday night with Bobby Sloak, their offensive coordinator. Everything looks the same. Outside zone, looks like play action pass at the same time. Can you start to blend those two together, your run and your pass game? Get more production. Create more manageable down and distance situations. And also utilize the running backs more in the pass game. Can you take a player like DeAndre Swift and move him outside to a slot alignment? Can you take Cole Kmet playing off that, flex him outside if you don't have a Dune Zane or if you have Keenan Allen, who's not at 100%. You have to find more ways to manufacture production when you have injuries. My first answer is to go back to the run game.
The Brian Billick doctrine is run away from strength, run at speed. Last week, they faced a team in the Titans with two big, nasty guys in the middle of that defense, and now it's much more so on the edges. Yeah. How does that affect the plan in the run game that you want?
Well, I think you run more inside zone. That's what I would do. More inside zone, more gap, downhill gap concepts, where you can attack the interior of the Houston defensive front. Because I agree with you, what they have on the edges is much different than you saw in Houston with Tennessee last week. But I do think that's a part of it, Dan, but also the screen game. When you have edge rushers that can get upfield, that can create pocket disruption with their first step off the football, you have to get the screen game going as well. I'm not talking about the wide receiver screens. I'm talking about the running back screens. That's one way to attack speed, right? When you have speed in the edges, obviously draw is an answer, but it's usually the screen game. So it's another way, like we're talking about, to get the running backs more involved.
I will be a little bit surprised if we see Velus Jones Jr. out there on Sunday. Will you, Matt?
Yes, I would be surprised, because you just can't put the football on the ground. You just can't do that, not in special teams. And look, the Bears special teams outside of that play were that won the football game. Okay, the kick return they had, the block punt, scoop and score for a touchdown, that won the football game for them. And it's something I was thinking about before I came on, guys. And I heard this a long time ago when I was a player at Iowa from Norm Parker, our former defense coordinator, who's now passed on. And Norm was outstanding, and he was a teacher too. And one thing he said that I've always thought of is never turn a win into a loss, right? Never turn a win into a loss. And I know we expected just this offensive explosion last week. We didn't see it, right? But we saw a team win a football game because they took the ball away on defense. They scored on defense. They scored on special teams. There's so many different ways to win a football game. But playing off of that, going back to your question there, you can't put the football on the ground. Not in this league when possessions are so limited at times. And when you turn the ball over on special teams and you give an offense a short field, you don't get many of those opportunities. So I would be surprised.
I was very impressed overall with not just the Bears' quality of tackling, which usually I sort of give a pass early in the season because of the lack of it that goes on in training camp and practices.
Sure. Now.
But the adjustments that Matt Eberflus made, you know, we had a recent guest, I think it was yesterday, just that said Matt Eberflus is an elite caller of a game, an elite game planner, and we're in an elite play caller as a defensive coordinator. Do you agree? Did you see him make those changes as the game went on? When did you see it change, and what did it do?
Well, I think one thing that, and Dan, I think we talked about this last year. If you go back to when Coach Eberflus was in Indianapolis, and you look at their coverage metrics and what they were, and everyone always points to cover three and cover two, the zone coverages, but they were pressure heavy at times. And I think that's one thing that Coach Eberflus does an excellent job of, when to call pressure. Because, Dan, you and I could stay on the sideline and say, let's blitz this play, right? Anyone can do that. But when do you do it? It has to be calculated. Why are you sending pressure? Is there a certain protection you can attack? Is there a certain player in protection you can attack? Does it come from the field side? Does it come from the boundary side? And ultimately, why are you calling the pressure? Do you believe in a certain coverage rotation and the ability to change the picture versus a young quarterback in Will Levis, okay, who, like we talked about, Dan, is a very aggressive throwing mentality and doesn't want to give up on plays. Okay, we saw what that led to late in the football game. But there's an art to calling defensive football. And there's an art to calling when to blitz and when to bring pressure and how to bring pressure. And I think that's one thing that Matt Eberflus does very well.
I look at this game, and I looked at it since the schedule came out, as a game that I didn't think the Bears were going to win, just on general principle of being on the road, rookie quarterback. We know what C.J. Stroud is and how good the Texans were last year. Is there a reason for me to look at this game, Matt, and not be okay with the fact that they could lose the game but be playing much better on offense and take solace? I know there's no moral victories, but in the course of a season, you need to have progress from your rookie quarterback. So is it bad that I'm okay with them taking the L but seeing Caleb Williams and the offense do way better than they did in game one?
No, I don't think so, Marshall, because you want to see progression, right? That's what you want to see. There should be a jump from game one to game two and so on down the season. And even when you have steps backwards, because the young quarterbacks in this league are going to have down games somewhere in the middle of the season too. Can you then go forward the next week? So you do want to see progression offensively. You do want to see an offense win on third downs. You want to see an offense win inside the red zone, right, when they didn't last week. And those are the critical moments that win or lose football games. So can they execute better in the red zone? Can they execute more in third down? Can they create explosive plays? If you want to stay in the game versus Houston, you're going to have to create explosive plays in the pass game. There's no question about that. You have to. And you have to extend drives. Because look what Houston did last week against the Colts. They had 40 rushing attempts. C.J. Stroud had 32 passing attempts. That is complete ball control offense. And they are a different football team now with Joe Mixon at running back. They are different. That is an added dynamic to their football team that gives them a downhill runner with power on contact and can finish at the point of attack. I think that's what Bobby Slowik wants to be. He wants to be balanced. You know, coming from that San Francisco coaching tree, he wants to be balanced. They want to use misdirection. They want to use pre-snap movement. And they want to be in position where they completely control the tempo of the football game. So if you're going to compete with them, especially on the road on a national stage, you have to create explosives on the pass game with Caleb Williams.
Was Coleman Shelton bad because it was just a bad matchup against a really good interior, or was he bad because he's bad?
I think he had some rough moments. Obviously, the matchup is tough. That is, I think, one of the best defensive interiors in the NFL, both in playing the run and their ability to push the pocket, right? But there's even when you're in a negative matchup, technique still has to be there. Okay, your footwork still has to be there. Hand placement has to be there. Your leverage has to be there. And at times, I think that was poor in that football game. So, again, if you're looking for something to watch this week, even though the matchup isn't the same on the interior, are they better on the interior? Are they better in pass protection to where Caleb Williams doesn't have to escape pressure, doesn't have to work backwards, doesn't have to eject the pocket so quickly? Can they do those things? Can they make those corrections? Because last week, I'm just telling you, it simply was not good enough from a standpoint of professional football.
One of the reasons I do love this matchup, and I like the way that week one was like a lesser opponent than week two is going to be, you get to a different type of measuring stick. Everybody, of course, excited about what the defense displayed in the back half of last season against, you could say, lesser competition in a lot of those cases. And then in week one against, you know, Will Levis, who's still trying to find his way out of the mayonnaise. Now you've got C.J. Stroud. What is it that they can do to be more effective against the second-year quarterback than all these other teams have, who have had so many problems with him over the last season plus one game?
Well, I think C.J. Stroud, and when I watch C.J. Stroud play, the first thing I say about him is he has excellent poise. And we don't talk about that enough at the quarterback position. It's all about arm talent, movement traits, et cetera. The poise matters so much. He plays like a veteran. He is so calm inside the pocket. And when you watch him play, it reminds me of Joe Burrow. That's what I see, a timing and rhythm thrower that can anticipate windows, has great accelerated vision, and will move when he has to. But when he moves to be a thrower. So he will escape, work laterally to the line of scrimmage, and extend plays to throw the football. That's one area. You have to contain him. You have to keep him inside the pocket, right? Don't let him escape and extend plays to where he can work the ball to multiple levels of the field. I think you really have to squeeze windows because he is so good at anticipating where those windows are going to be. That means linebackers have to get to depth and be in position to drive laterally to get hands on the football. And in the secondary, you cannot give up the throws over the top because they're going to take their shots down the field. Nico Collins can work down the field. Stephon Diggs can work down the field. Tank Dell is absolutely electric. When he gets isolated, his sudden movement skills, he can take you vertically over the top. So there's just a couple things right there because he does play like a quarterback with so much more experience than he really has. And I think right now, if you're a young quarterback in this league, this rookie class, that's who you're going to be compared to moving forward.
Matt, something we talked about yesterday, where I'm not really sure there's a right answer, but it started making me feel weird to project sort of typical Bears football response on maybe a once-in-a-lifetime quarterbacking prospect to say, simplify things, make it easier on him, maybe not so many full-field reads off five-step drops, roll him out, have layered throws with half-field reads, and then I realized we're doing it again, and this was supposed to be someone so talented and so special that we didn't need to default to these well-worn sort of the comfy shoes of being a Bears fan of saying these things, because I thought we were done with this. Should we be, and should we keep all the stuff in there that tries to get the most out of his talent?
That's a great question, Dan. I kind of agree with you on some aspects here. I think you need to give young quarterbacks in September some easy throws to start football games, okay? You talked about rolling them out. It's okay to use some boot concepts, some sprint concepts. Give him some defined reads early in football game to build his confidence. But to your point, to see real growth and real progression, you need the full field reads, okay? You need to play the position like a veteran quarterback. And that's a progression throughout the season. When that fully happens, we don't know. But again, going into a game like this, Dan, cutting the field in half is not going to be enough, in my opinion. It's not. And Caleb Williams does have that ability, does have the traits, does have the football intelligence, does have the arm talent to work all levels of the field, to get to the backside read when he has to. We know he can do that. So it's just, Dan, when do you want to do that from a play-calling perspective? At what point of the season? Is it week two? Is it Sunday night? Is it the second quarter Sunday night? Or does it depend on game flow, too? Or is it a situation where a young quarterback goes to a coordinator and tells him throughout a football game, I need more. I need more. I need to be in a position to attack the outside third of the field more. You know, give me those calls that put me in that position. So there's a lot of things that go into it, but I do believe he can do that, and I do believe that's ultimately where you want to get to this season.
Just the way we've all been talking about the Texans, I'm just curious as to your opinion. If I say fill in the blank and say the Texans are the blank best team in the NFL, what number would you give them right now?
I would say they're a top 10 team. And because of the talent on both sides of the ball, but especially the coaching. D'Amico Ryans is an excellent coach. An excellent leader for that organization. Now, Bobby Sloak, I knew Bobby Sloak when he was a little kid. So his dad was my DB coach in Green Bay. So Bobby Sloak has been around football his entire life, okay? And you look at the coaches he's worked for and what he did last year from a play-calling perspective. He's someone that eventually I think will be talked about it or be in the discussion of being a head coach in the National Football League. So they have a great organization
Didn't he turn down some second interviews? I mean, there was a point where he decided he was happy where he was.
He did. He did. And, we don't know the reason for that, Dan, but I can say this. If I'm in his place and I'm looking at what I have coming back in Houston and what we can do offensively, and maybe this was the right fit for him in terms of those interviews, but there's no question they're going to be in a position again this year where they're probably going to be a playoff team, and he'll have more opportunities for that. But they are very well coached. It's the one thing you see right away when you turn the tape on Houston, how well coached they are and how disciplined they are.
Matt Bowen, thank you as always. Much appreciated, and look forward to talking again next week.
All right, guys. Thank you.
That is Matt Bowen, who joins us weekly to give us his unique perspective on the Bears and the NFL. I should mention, because I didn't before, that you can follow Matt Bowen on Twitter, at MattBowen41.
I just love listening to him talk about football.
I know.
That's the thing. Like, the way he speaks about the game is with such a...
It's matter of fact.
Yeah, it's matter of fact, but it's passionate, but it's not over the top. It's just like, hey, this is my opinion on this, and hey, I'm listening.
What did you say before about Caleb and authenticity?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know it when you hear it,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And indeed, and you're lucky to hear Matt Bowen here at noon on Thursdays on Sports Radio 670. Next up, Jerry Reinsdorf released a statement.
Oh, my goodness. See, you just turned the tide right there.
My headline on it is, it would be absolutely galling if it weren't just sad. We'll talk about it next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, middays 10 to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com in Odyssey Station.
Long before I even thought that I'd be making a change, I was very well aware of what Chris was doing in the minor leagues. Because I've told a lot of people, for the first time ever since I've been here, we were teaching baseball in the minor leagues the way I wanted it to be taught. My first feeling was, okay, I'll interview an internal candidate, and then I'm going to ask permission to talk to all of these other guys. But that moved me to the thought that, what is it that I owe to fans? And I think one of the things that I owe to fans is to get better as fast as we can possibly get better. The speed is of the essence. I don't want this to be a long-term proposition.
Oh, boy. Wow.
He said that?
He said a lot more than that.
Yeah, I remember when he said that.
And that was Jerry Reinsdorf when he hired Chris Getz, because with Getz's experience in the organization, they wouldn't have to waste a year with somebody getting to know what was going on. And look, Chris Getz sort of just weaseled his way into this job. And I've said it before, the entire organization, in at least in the baseball side, has been a nest of weasels for too long. They tried to clear some of them out. They attempted to change the culture there to minimal avail. And it was also at that press conference that Jerry Reinsdorf said his favorite player of all time is David Eckstein, even though he had Frank Thomas on his team. And he talked about Eddie Stanky back from his days with the Brooklyn Dodgers.
David Eckstein.
That favorite player, even though he was bad. His favorite player is bad. He had Frank Thomas. Frank Thomas on the White Sox.
You mean the guy I had on my poster on the bedroom wall, Batman and Robin? That Frank Thomas? Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah. Well, that's right. Between Alabama and...
Oh,
and
remember, my first probably 10 baseball games were Birmingham Barons games.
Oh,
I lived in Birmingham until I was 10. And then we moved to Huntsville, and then I got to see, like, Jordan and them play when I was in high school. So, like, let me just... Can we just start with this? Like, I think you're giving Jerry Reinsdorf a pass when you say Chris Getz weaseled his way into... No. Jerry Reinsdorf is in charge. He decided to promote Chris Getz, mm-hmm. and then he said what he said, which we played off the top. The only person that Jerry Reinsdorf has to blame for what has happened to the White Sox is Jerry Reinsdorf.
With that said, let's read the statement that was issued yesterday. And apparently the response was, this was released due to a number of requests from area outlets to basically say, hey, Jerry, you're the guy. Is this okay? You're the worst baseball team of all time. Is it okay? After everything he said about not wasting time and hitting the ground running and not making a long-term proposition, they're the worst team in the history of baseball. This is after the 114th loss of the season. Jerry Reinsdorf issued this statement. Everyone in this organization is extremely unhappy with the results of this season. That goes without saying. This year has been very painful for all, especially our fans. We did not arrive here overnight. And solutions won't happen overnight either. Going back to last year, we have made difficult decisions and changes to begin building a foundation for future success. What has impressed me is how our players and staff have continued to work and bring a professional attitude to the ballpark each day, despite a historically difficult season. No one is happy with the results, but I commend the continued effort. I expect to have more to say at the end of the season. Jerry, the season ended in April.
That's fair.
This is the end of the season. This is long past the end of the season. And I will not forget, and I will not let you forget, that they had it. Everything he wanted, everything they had built, based on trades for the future, based on an exciting and somewhat risky but edgy and fun marketing campaign, and based on their pursuit of a dynamic young manager, they had it. And what did Jerry Reinsdorf do? He hired Tony La Russa.
Is that for you the marker? Is that where it starts?
100%. 100%. They had it. And there is as a White Sox executive told me, he said, we had this thing by the balls. They did. And they were going to hire A.J. Hinch.
Yes, I remember this.
His name was on the graphic. It was already there. They were going to hire somebody who knows what he's doing, who's ready for the next wave of managing. He hired Tony La Russa. They burned down the culture. They ruined everything. Tony La Russa was the largest single contributor to ruining everything. And he's still there. When he says our players and staff, Tony La Russa. I commend the continued effort of Tony La Russa. Tony La Russa remains attached to Jerry Reinsdorf's hip. He remains, whether by title or simply by de facto, the highest ranking baseball voice in the organization due to his proximity to Jerry Reinsdorf, his proximity to power. Jerry Reinsdorf is standing in the ashes of a building that he burned down and saying, well, nobody's happy. Nobody's happy this all burned down, but, well, I commend the effort. You wrecked it because you installed your guy for no good reason other than your personal whim.
I want to start with the last thing he said in that statement, which is, I expect to have more to say at the end of the season. My question and answer to that is, when you say more to say at the end of the season, is that to the select group of people that you actually take questions from, or is it going to be open forum for all media members to question the decisions that have been made? Because last time I checked, last offseason, that's what he had, like a small little where he didn't want to let everyone ask questions. They tried to shuttle in the baseball writers, the beat writers, and do their own thing, and everyone wasn't allowed to ask questions. Which, you know what? You're the owner. You can do whatever you want. But we talked earlier about transparency. We talked earlier about authenticity, right? For all the White Sox fans and their hurt that he addressed in that statement, that hurt is real. That hurt has turned for many to apathy, for many to anger. You never want to have apathy, and that's where we are.
So far past anger. It's like that.
That's what I'm saying. When you get past anger and you settle into the apathy and it's like quicksand and you're sinking down, that's where White Sox fans are right now. You know why I can say that freely? I'm a White Sox fan. Born and raised a White Sox fan. And so
you
want to turn the page, but the page can't be turned for the many reasons that you just stated. And I think for all of us waiting to see what's next, it's like, how is it going to get better? You know, are there more Andrew Benintendis for you to go out and spend money on and say, this is the biggest free agent signing in White Sox history? Now, granted, Benintendi's having a better year than last year, but everybody's
bad.
Having a better year than last year.
His WRC plus is 85.
I get it.
But it's better than Luis Roberts.
Which is telling in and of itself. I don't know what's going on with Luis Robert Jr. I think also for me, it sounds bad when I say this, but nothing is going to change unless Jerry Reinsdorf is not making the decisions. And he'll always be making the decisions so long as he owns the team.
The only words White Sox fans want to hear that will give them any sense of hope is the team is up for sale. Those are the only words left.
The words about a new ballpark?
Now you're trolling. The only words,
I'm definitely trolling
the
you right
only
now.
Words that are left. It's like the Pandora's box. All the evils escape into the world, and what is left at the bottom? What's the last word left for Pandora? Hope. And I think hope may have flown out of this too. I think hope may have burned to the ground too. And this is something that they were so close. The excitement level was so real, and it was on the precipice of something. And he decided to indulge his own personal whim in a way that scuttled the culture that they'd built. It scuttled all the goodwill with fans who had bought in to the sacrifices that were made and had made that tacit agreement to do that. And I like the text where Southside Pete says, the word isn't apathy, it's disgust. If you can still summon that.
That's what I'm saying.
If you can still summon
disgust.
Apathy
is beyond disgust.
Good for you.
That's the whole point. Apathy is beyond disgust, because disgust means you still care. You still pay attention. Who's paying attention to... besides myself, of course, to White Sox games on a nightly basis.
You are?
I tune in. I want to see what Drew Cannon can do. I want to know. Call it curiosity. Call it just, I like sports in the background. You know,
no,
baseball is the soundtrack of summer, right? And,
yeah.
And summer is ending.
And don't forget that soundtrack of summer used to involve one of the great broadcasters in the game. And Jerry Reinsdorf, again on a whim.
I don't think it was a whim. I think he just didn't like him.
It's what I mean. He had the power to do it, and he did it, and he didn't like him. And he didn't like negotiating the number of games he was going to do. He didn't like watching him eat on the air. He didn't think his jokes were funny. And now he's gone too. And it's the heartbreak of some of that stuff is unforgivable.
What's crazy to me is, I'm sorry, it's not crazy to me. What I've realized over my time of following this team, specifically in the last 3 years that I've been in Chicago, because, you know, I was at, you know, they go to a playoff series, they get worked by the Astros, you know, it is what it is, right? But everybody who makes a bad decision, because we all make bad decisions, right? The difference between making a bad decision and being a bad decision maker is not understanding that you can change course after a bad decision.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I've seen the failure to change course after a bad decision, not doing it in a timely fashion. And that's really what's haunting this franchise right now.
That's Marshall Harris. He's in for Lawrence Holmes here on the Bernstein and Holmes Show. I'm Dan Bernstein. And boy, a lot of people are coming out and having lunch and having fun. And you should, because we are here out and about. 670 The Score, live in the Lake Street Plaza at Prue. It's a lovely park, an abundance of outdoor seating. There's beautiful greenery. We've got food kiosks. And there's a food truck that just pulled up. A massive high-def Golden Tee game is set up. People throwing footballs at targets, and we've got mini footballs, and we've got plenty of Score merch. And I realize some of the Circa folks are arriving right now, and that means soon. Circa Sports Illinois is going to have their merch for you when you download the app and deposit. They've got all sorts of free bonus merchandise for you. So come out. You could not have a lovelier late summer, early meteorological fall day than we have today. So you are certainly welcome. When we come back, Tyreek Hill spoke yesterday and also had a little bit of accountability for the incident that went on. And what did you phrase it? Great athlete privilege?
Yeah, athlete privilege. People who their whole lives have been catered to step one through Z. And that's what this was a case of.
A Z.
Yeah. No, one Z. Because we're going all the way through the numbers and the alpha.
All of it through.
The alphanumeric.
That's a big span of letters and numbers. We'll talk about it next on The Score.
Bernstein and Holmes, your midday destination for Chicago sports talk on 670 The Score.
Well, actually, they put handcuffs on me, too, and I was like, what is going on? You know, I mean, I didn't understand what the cop was, what the issue was. You know, for him to put handcuffs on me, I felt some kind of way. But, you know, that just goes to show our resilience. So we didn't let that stop us. We just got back in line, got focused again, and went out there and played a good football game. But that definitely was an interesting way to start a ball game.
Absolutely. They put handcuffs on you?
Yes.
So how did that feel? Like, how did you manage your emotions of that moment and then still come out here and do what you did?
Yeah, that was the first. You know, being 17 years in this game, you know, I don't really see a lot of first, but I saw Tyreek, you know, getting apprehended. I just wanted to make sure everything was okay, trying to de-escalate the situation. I was felt some kind of way, put handcuffs on me, and then, you know, I just told myself, like, hey, don't let this get you down. Just get focused, stay locked in, and just do what you know you're prepared to do so you go ahead and win a ball game.
Veteran defender Calais Campbell of the Miami Dolphins, which is, when you consider the fact that he was also accosted, there may not be a gentler guy in the NFL. I mean, just an absolute sweetheart of a guy who was also dragged in to this latest incident between athletes and police that unnecessarily seemed to escalate. So it sucks. And I appreciate those who have pointed out the number of years and the amount of heat and emotion that has been spent over one NFL player deciding to protest exactly this kind of thing. And he was shouted down and blackballed and basically never to be heard from again, with the exception of the terrific things that he's doing on his own. But it was Tyreek Hill who was in the middle of it. And I have to say this also. I know we haven't, you know, worked together in this capacity before, Marshall, but I just something that I feel it's important when we do talk about these things that I'm going to have an opinion on it, but I know that my opinion is not as informed or valid or meaningful than others who have been through the situation or who have grown up knowing they could find themselves in a situation like that. And I know it because I am aware of my own white privilege. And I just have to make sure that you know that I am aware of it, that you listening to The Score, you know I'm also aware of it. And I can't begin to put myself in the shoes of the people that go through some of these things.
I think for people who watch, because there's obviously so many angles, so much footage taken of this incident, right? And they're like, how could this happen? I don't want to hear anybody else say, how could this happen? This happens all the time. Like
every day.
Just be aware that this happens. I think the shock of how could this happen wasn't necessarily the component that we normally see. It's more the fact that this was an athlete outside of his workplace, which AKA is the stadium where fans are, where other players are, that this was happening to. Now, Tyreek Hill, obviously in the wrong. They said, 60 miles per hour is what he was estimated to to be driving in a residential area. Obviously, there's lots of foot traffic, pedestrians. So he gets pulled over. Should be a citation, everything else. And, you know, he rolls up his window, and tinted window, probably shouldn't do that because they can't see in your car. We know from the video that they knew it was Tyreek Hill. It wasn't just some random guy. But all that to end up with a guy with a knee in his back on the ground and him calling for an officer to be fired, all that is crazy. But what's even crazier is that he was, like, kind of in disbelief, like this couldn't happen to him. And that's where I was like, come on, man. And then I find out he not only wants to be a cop, but he has law enforcement officers in his family. No one ever told him, like, that this was a thing that happens?
Let's hear from Tyreek Hill when he spoke to reporters yesterday about the incident.
Not everybody has the same resources as Tyreek Hill. Not everybody has the name Tyreek Hill or not able to call a Drew Brooks or Drew Rosenhaus or something like that, man. So I'm really, like, unfazed to it. You feel me? You know, so that's why I was able to go out and play the way I did, because I'm numb to it. You know, it's kind of expected, so.
And then, just to follow up, you said that you would have handled yourself a little bit differently. For other people out there seeing that video, is there a message that you may have for them about how to handle themselves in a similar situation?
I don't have a message for them yet, but I'm sure I will. So ask me that question again next week sometime. So I'm pretty sure I will, because right now I'm in the process of, you know, putting together a good plan, so that way I can work with those guys. Because I think it's good, man. I think we should lean on each other, you know? Like, we have influence on the community, and I don't think that we should, you know, use this as a moment to, you know, separate, you know, people or divide people or, you know, make it a battle or anything like that, man. Because I still love cops, you know? I want to be a cop. I've been standing on the table for the cops, man, but at the end of the day, right now what I'm focused on is my job, and that's to play football, you know, and that's all that I can be, the best baller, football player I can be, man, so.
Now, you hear that to say, Dan, everything he said there, and he talked about what we talked about, and he kind of hedged on what his message would be, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say in a week's time.
Yeah, I would definitely, as a reporter, if someone tells me, ask me that next week, you best believe I'm going to.
So what I want to do with this is, it's obviously, he's a Miami Dolphin, one of the most famous players in the NFL. His name is Cheetah. Everybody knows who this guy. Noah Lyles, even if you weren't NFL familiar, if you followed track and field, you know about him and the Noah Lyles saga. My thing is, this whole thing opened up my eyes to something else that I thought we had gotten past, but we haven't, and that is the OJification of athletes, as I call it. OJification as in O.J. Simpson. As in O.J. Simpson lived a life as a black man where he felt like, I'm not black, I'm O.J. There was, you know, Jay-Z wrote a whole song about it, right? The story of O.J. back in, I don't remember, it was a long time ago, when he was still with us. But, like, some people believe because of their wealth, their status, whatever, that they are immune to certain things that other people might face in their same conditions. To me, this was a perfect example of that for Tyreek Hill, and it was a wake-up call of sorts because of what happened and how it happened, and he couldn't quite believe it happened, but he's like, it's to be expected. So that means he's aware it happens to other people. He just thought he was above the fray, if you will.
He did mitigate that, I thought, when he talked about not everybody can call Drew Rosenhaus.
Right.
And I think that was his way of checking a little bit of privilege. I think his way of understanding that. I don't think he did it as eloquently as he could have.
But I think he doesn't do that unless he goes through the experience. That's the whole point.
You don't think he's been through the experience before?
I don't know that he has. Like, the way he sounded both after the game immediately and then talking later about it, it just sounds like he knows it's messed up. But he didn't expect to be in that situation. And that's because he's Tyreek Hill.
And maybe he's reminded that it can happen to anybody.
Exactly.
Even if it happens and they know you're Tyreek Hill at that point.
I can't speak for everyone. All the people I know growing up, we all got the same talk about how to deal with the police in a way, because your life is endangered. It could be endangered. And your parents are like, at the end of the day, we just want you to come home.
Well, see, I've never gotten that talk. That's the difference. I did not. Growing up where I grew up, that was not a worry. And I've and when I'm aware of that, and as I've become aware of that, and those people who have, you know, we talk about two Chicagos a lot, but it's more than that.
Oh, it's two Americas. It's two Americas.
Indeed, there are. And when we learn to understand and appreciate that, it's growing up that way to have gotten have your mom or dad sit you down and say, look, this is something about which you have to be concerned. And I never got that. I didn't know what that was like.
Yeah, so I did. All my friends did. Like, it was a common, this is a thing because of the police in different places and how they act. And, you know, you get pulled over, 10 and 2 on the wheel, have your driver's license, have your hands showing at all times. It's like there's very specific rules to follow, which everyone should follow, I guess. But it's harped on more and more for people of color, I think, black and brown people. But, hey, Maybe I'm speaking just from my experience. I don't want to say it's anecdotal, though, because I feel like there's statistics to back all this up. And I just think it was a telling thing for all of us to see it play out yet again. Luckily, no one was harmed, none worse for wear. And so that's kind of my takeaway from it. But the athlete privilege was on display for Tyreek Hill, and I think he'll be a little bit more careful going forward.
That's Marshall Harris. I'm Dan Bernstein. This is the Bernstein and Holmes Show here at Prue Plaza on Lake Street. Feel free to come join us for the final hour of our show. Next up, I will let you decide whether or not Matt Eberflus raised the stakes for the improvement of his offensive line's play with something he said yesterday. And we can dig a little deeper into what's going on with the big fat guys up front on offense next on The Score.